We come now to look at the division of the land of Canaan. Last Sunday morning, we saw the entry into Canaan in the first five chapters. And then on Sunday evening, we looked at the conquest of the land. Chapters 6, 7, and 8, we saw how they drove through the center first. And then in chapter 9, and leading on into chapter 10, we found they then moved and conquered the southern areas. And then in chapter 11, up and conquered the northern area. Then at the end of chapter 11 and moving on through into chapter 12, it summarized the whole of the conquest, which you can divide into two parts. East of the Jordan River, you have 2.5 tribes occupying that land. And west of the Jordan River, that is between the Jordan and the Mediterranean Sea, or Canaan proper, that was divided between 9.5 tribes. And that was summarized in the latter part of chapter 11 and chapter 12. The one tribe that was halved was the tribe of Manasseh. We now come to chapter 13, and we see now something concerning the dividing up of the land. Now, if you read through these chapters, you probably found that they were dead boring. All they seem to be is lists of names and places. Well, I want to go through them today and see what we can learn from them. The consolation, of course, is that it can't go longer than half an hour, and if we're going to do such a large area in that short time, well, it means we're going to pick out the more interesting features. Although they'd conquered the whole of the land, let us not think that they occupied every square mile of the country. The conquest was general, that is, they had taken possession of the whole of the territory, which you see marked out on the map there, in its broad outline. But within each of these tribal areas, there were pockets of Canaanite resistance. These were largely the plain areas. The Israelites took control of the hill country, but they were not able to exercise their dominion over the plain areas because the local inhabitants had chariots, which of course operate in plain country, and these were superior to the Israelite forces. But they were a minority, that is, these Canaanite resistance pockets were a minority in the country. What was going to happen now was that as the land had now been taken, it would be divided between the 12 tribes, and it was now the duty of each of those 12 tribes to clean out the Canaanite pockets that were in its own tribal area. That's the significance of the first verse of chapter 13. Joshua is old and advanced in years, and the Lord said to him, "You are old and advanced in years, and there remains yet very much land to be possessed." That is, the land within the overall borders that Israel had conquered. The trouble was, the people were tired of conquest. They had had about 5 years, at least 5 years of war. Now, we went through it last Sunday evening in half an hour, and you may get the impression through a quick read through like that that the war was very swift. Well, actually, it was a rather long, drawn out affair. We glossed over one verse in chapter 11 where it says that Joshua made war a long time with all those kings, and the long time turns out to be at least 5 years. I'll give the justification for that later on as we come to some further details. But the people had grown tired of war, and now that they had got so far, they decided they'd settle for what they had, and the temptation now was to build themselves houses, to settle down and make life comfortable for themselves. And after 5 years out of war, they didn't feel like fighting any longer. And you find that as a result, these pockets of Canaanites were not cleaned out as they should have been. And the old story was that those opponents that they failed to eradicate later on became the means of their downfall. And it's just a very small picture of the problem which all of us face in any area of our lives. It's those things which we have to get the better of. If we don't get the better of them, then sooner or later they'll get the better of us. And that really is the message which comes through in the following book when you see the consequences of Israel's failure to completely eradicate the enemy. And you come on then into the next book in Judges and you see the troubles that resulted. All right, we come now to chapter 13. What I want to do is just light upon certain features in these chapters. Chapter 13, the first 7 verses, summarize the area west of Jordan, that is Canaan itself, and it points out the regions that still required attention if Israel was to possess the land completely as God desired for them. So you come to verse 7, and it summarizes it by saying, "Now therefore, divide this land," that is the land that's just been talked about in the previous 6 verses, divide this land for an inheritance to the 9 tribes and the half tribe of Manasseh. So Canaan itself was divided between 9 and a half tribes. We come to this area east of the River Jordan, and in verse 8, it says the other half of the tribe of Manasseh, along with the tribes of Reuben and Gad, received their inheritance, which Moses gave them, beyond the Jordan eastward. That territory had been conquered during the time of Moses. And then Moses died, and Joshua took over the leadership, and it was under Joshua that the land of Canaan itself was conquered. So there you have 9 and a half plus 2 and a half equals your 12 tribes. Until you come to verse 14, and you find that the tribe of Levi alone, Moses gave no inheritance. That is, they had no tribal area of their own. What happened with Levi was that they received cities, the Levites received cities in all of the tribal areas. Now you say, well, what happens to our 12 tribes? That gives us 13 now. Well, the answer to the problem is this. In ancient times, the firstborn of the family who received the inheritance, or the firstborn's inheritance, he received twice what everybody else received. The firstborn of Jacob's family was Reuben. But Reuben had forfeited the inheritance of the firstborn because he had raped his stepmother. And so the firstborn's prize was taken from him and given to the favorite son, Joseph, which means that Joseph received 2 tribes, whereas all the other sons received 1 each. The 2 tribes which Joseph received took the names, or followed the lineage of his 2 sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. So with the tribe of Levi not receiving its inheritance, we're down to 11 divisions, but because Joseph got 2, we're back to 12. So the land was divided between these 12 tribes. The 12 tribes are 10 sons of Jacob and 2 grandsons of Jacob. Now, first of all, in the remaining part of chapter 13, it goes on to detail the territory that was occupied by these 2 and a half eastern tribes. Verse 15 tells us of the inheritance of the Reubenites, and if you read through the verses that follow, you'll find they occupy that area to the south, east of the Dead Sea. You come to verse 24, and it introduces us to the Gadites, the people of the tribe of Gad, who are sometimes referred to as Gilead, because Gilead was the main region that the people of Gad occupied, and they had the central portion there, east of the river. And in verse 29, you come to the half-tribe of Manasseh, which inherited the northern part east of the Jordan River. So that disposes of those 2 and a half tribes. We now come to the 9 and a half tribes west of the river. And firstly, you'll find that 2 and a half tribes are dealt with specifically. Those 2 and a half tribes are the other half of Manasseh, plus Ephraim, plus Judah. And they are the powerful tribes. If you went back to the latter chapters of the book of Genesis, you'd find that when Jacob gave his blessings to his sons and his grandsons, the lion's share of the blessings were heaped upon Judah and Joseph. And when you come into the land, you find that Judah and Joseph between them received the majority of Canaan. You just look at the map there, you can see Judah in the south, and then the 2 Joseph tribes, which are Ephraim, and then half of Manasseh, one side of the river, and half on the other. Don't be deceived by the extent of Judah's territory. It was a lot in area, but it wasn't terribly fertile, and it was more thinly populated. But the area that Ephraim and Manasseh got right in the center was really the pick of the whole country. So if you put together the extent of their area, plus the quality of the land, Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh, really got the pick of the country, and Judah, of course, got the largest area. The Joseph and Judah tribes are dealt with first. So that accounts for our other 2 and a half. Judah plus Ephraim plus the other half of Manasseh. What I want to do now is to look at those 3 tribes and just find one incident that's recounted here in these verses and see if we can learn something from it. Which brings us to chapter 14. And in verse 6, the people of Judah came to Joshua at Gilgal. Remember, we said that Gilgal was the center of operations for the 5 years' war. And Caleb came to him. Now, Caleb and Joshua knew each other well, and they were the 2 old men of Israel. They were much, much older than anybody else in the country. You'll remember that going back in the book of Numbers, when the spies went to spy out the land, Joshua and Caleb were the only 2 that said, we can take the land. And they were the only 2 among the adult population who were preserved alive and eventually entered the land. So they are well and truly the senior citizens of Israel. Joshua was from the tribe of Ephraim, and Caleb was from the tribe of Judah. So once again, you have these two prominent tribes featuring. In fact, if you look at the history which follows here, you find that the whole of the future history of Israel, from this point in Joshua onwards, really boils down to some sort of power struggle between Judah in the south and Ephraim in the center. And when later on the kingdom broke, it was Ephraim in the north which broke away and was the leading tribe in the northern kingdom, leaving Judah with a few smaller areas attached to it in the south. All right, we find that Caleb in verse 6 came to Joshua, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, that is Caleb, is the son of Jephunneh. He said, "You know what the Lord said to Moses, the man of God, in Kadesh Barnea concerning you and me," that is at the time of the expedition of the spies. "I was 40 years old then," he says. "I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land. And I brought him word again as it was in my heart." And you know what the word is? That Joshua and Caleb said, "Let's go and conquer." And Caleb specifically said, "We can conquer the Anakim." The Anakim were the people of Anak. And the I-M you get on the end of these words in the Old Testament simply is the plural ending. The Anakim were a race of huge people. They were fearsome. And the Israelites said, "We'll never defeat them." Caleb came back and said, "We can defeat them, and we will defeat them." But the people didn't believe him. And so the Anakim went unconquered. Well, now the time has come 45 years later in verse 10. He says, "Behold, the Lord has kept me alive, and he said to me these 45 years since the time that the Lord spoke this word to Moses while Israel walked in the wilderness. And now, lo, I am this day 85 years old." That 45 years consists of approximately 40 years of their wanderings in the wilderness. Actually, it was less than 40 years, which means that we have something in excess of 5 years for the conquest, 5 years for the war. Verse 11, the old man says, "I am still as strong to this day as I was in the day that Moses sent me. My strength now is as my strength was then, for war and for going and coming. So now give me this hill country of which the Lord spoke on that day. For you heard on that day how the Anakim were there with great fortified cities. It may be that the Lord will be with me, and I shall drive them out as the Lord said." And then Joshua blessed him, and he gave Hebron to Caleb the son of Jephunneh for an inheritance. Hebron down there in the south in the area of Judah. But the point is this: Caleb had said he can conquer them. That was when he was a good lusty man of 40 years of age. Here he is now 85 years of age, and it's been 45 years interval that he has not had the chance to demonstrate that he is as good as his word. Well, a man of 85 years of age would have every excuse, every reason for saying, "It's not my cup of tea." But Caleb said, "I am going to prove that the faith that I expressed then, I still hold on to now." And he proved that his faith was genuine by saying, "I'm going to go, and we're going to tackle these characters, and we're going to win." It's the old story that faith must prove itself through works. And if it's only a faith which comes out of our lips and we say something, and our works don't demonstrate that faith, then we have no right whatever to expect people to believe our expressions of faith. We express it through obedience. As the man in James says, one person will say, "I'll show you my faith without my works." But James says, "I'll show you my faith by my works." This is what we're all required to do. And it's one of the lessons that we've seen coming through in several places in the previous chapters. And so Caleb goes, Joshua gives him the inheritance there in Hebron, but the Anakim still live there. And so Caleb has to go and defeat them. You come across to chapter 15, verse 14, and you find that Caleb does defeat them. He drove out from there the three sons of Anak. Now that wasn't the end, because there was a nearby town called Debir. And Caleb said, "Okay, you young chaps, I've given you the example. Now you're not going to let an 85-year-old man put you to shame, are you? I've driven out the Anakim from here. Now are you chaps going to get the bit between your teeth and go up there and clean them out of Debir as well?" And so in verse 15, he went up from Hebron against the inhabitants of Debir. Now the name of Debir formerly was Kiriath Sepha. And Caleb said, "Whoever smites Kiriath Sepha and takes it, to him will I give Aksa, my daughter, as wife." And we find that the young men were spurred on by the example of the old man. And here again we have a good picture for us of how the boldness of one person can develop faith and courage in another. And let us never forget that people are always watching us and following our example, for better or for worse. And we find that Othniel in verse 17 took it. And if you read it on the story further into the book of Judges, you find that this man Othniel became one of the first of Israel's great leaders in the period following the death of Joshua. And so one thing leads to another, doesn't it? All because this man put his faith into practice. So much for the tribe of Judah. We come now to verse 1 of chapter 16, and we are introduced now to the allotment of the descendants of Joseph. And if you go down to verse 4, we'll find the people of Joseph are Manasseh and Ephraim. Now the point we're going to see here is that although Manasseh and Ephraim, between them, got the best part of all Canaan, they were still not satisfied. We go across to chapter 17, and we'll find the details spelt out for us. First of all, concerning the territory of Manasseh, which is mentioned in chapter 17, verse 7. It gives us all the details and the boundaries, which we won't read. You come down to verse 10, and you find that the land to the south, this is speaking of the two Joseph tribes, the land to the south was Ephraim's, and that to the north was Manasseh's, which is what you see there on the map. And the sea formed its boundary, that's the Mediterranean Sea on the west. On the north, Asher is reached, which is another encouragement that our map is correct. And on the east, Issachar, so those various tribes are mentioned. Now here's the point in verse 11. Also in Issachar and in Asher, Manasseh had Beth-shean and its villages, Ibleam and its villages, and the inhabitants of Dor and its villages, and the inhabitants of Endor and its villages, and the inhabitants of Taanach and its villages, and the inhabitants of Megiddo and its villages. The third is Naphath. Yet the sons of Manasseh could not take possession of those cities, but the Canaanites persisted in dwelling in that land. The point here is this. Manasseh was given all this territory, and it was a large chunk of land that they were given. The smaller tribes bordering them to the north also had territory given to them, as we'll find later on. But the Canaanites lived in much of this area along the border, just north, just out of Manasseh's territory. Now Manasseh came along and said, look, we're a stronger tribe, and I know that you chaps would like some help. What we'll do is, we'll shift our boundary, let's say 10 kilometers north, and we'll take over control of those villages, and we'll drive out the Canaanites for you. And the smaller tribes didn't really have much to argue about, and they couldn't have argued much anyway, because Manasseh probably would have done what it wanted. And we find that it did. And so it took control of those areas. Now it wasn't able to drive out the inhabitants of some of those towns within that area, but it didn't hand that territory back. It kept it for itself. And so that was just another way of Manasseh adding to its already liberal gift. It already had a large chunk of land. It now took some of the areas of the other tribes. It boasted that it could free them, free that territory for them, but Manasseh couldn't do it, but yet it didn't have the territory back. And so it increased its own territory by that amount. Just part of the greed of human nature, isn't it? That the more people get, the more they want. And we're all so confident that we can do something that somebody else can't do, and yet here is a case of Manasseh wasn't able to do it at all. But I don't find it backed down. It's stuck by its own selfish word. You come to another significant story in verse 14 through to the end, and this one again concerns the Joseph tribes, and as you read through, although you find both Manasseh and Ephraim are involved, you'll see that it involves more the territory of Ephraim than Manasseh. Verse 14, the tribe of Joseph spoke to Joshua, and they said, why have you given me but one lot and one portion as an inheritance, though I am a numerous people, since hitherto the Lord has blessed me? And Joshua said to them, if you are a numerous people, go up to the forest, and there clear ground for yourselves in the land of the Perizzites and the Rephaim, since the hill country of Ephraim is too narrow for you. You say you're a great multitude of people? Well, what are you sitting there for? If you're as many as you say you are, why don't you go and do something about it and clear some of the territory that you want to take? So Joshua wasn't backing down easily. He took them up on their own statement that they were a numerous people and said to them, all the more reason why you should work. Verse 16, the tribe of Joseph comes back with a complaint. And if you follow the story of the tribe of Ephraim through the rest of Joshua and Judges on into Samuel and Kings, you find that this was the tribe of whingers. They were always moaning and groaning about something. They were this people who were easily offended. There's nothing worse than people that go round with a look in their face asking that they might get offended. You know, the sorts of people. And this is what the people of Ephraim were like. Frankly, they were a nuisance. Well, you see it coming out here already. In verse 16, they said, "The hill country is not enough for us." So the hill country is not good enough. They haven't got enough hill country. It's too thickly forested and not enough for them. And they don't want to work to clear it. And then in the next breath they say, "And all the Canaanites who dwell in the plain have chariots of iron. So we can't conquer them either." Well, there's not much else, not much other place to go to, is there? If you do, the hill country is not enough and you can't live on the plain. About all you can do is construct houseboats and go and live out in the Mediterranean somewhere. Now here were people again who had the best part of the land, and yet they've always got a complaint, always got a moan about something. So this is not enough and that's not enough, and they wanted Joshua to hand the whole thing to them on a silver platter. Well, Joshua wasn't going to come into that. He says, "You've got the manpower, you admit you've got the manpower, get up and do something about it." That's what he says in verse 17. He said to the house of Joseph, to Ephraim and to Manasseh, "You are a numerous people, and you have great power. Okay, you shall not have one lot only, but the hill country shall be yours. But here's the crunch. For though it is a forest, you shall clear it and possess it to its farthest borders. And you shall drive out the Canaanites, even though they have chariots of iron and though they are strong." So you can have the hill country, and you can have the plain country. But you're not going to get the hill country unless you work for it, and you're not going to get the plain country unless you fight for it. And anything any of us achieve, we've got to be prepared for hard work. We've got to be prepared for battles. We've got to be prepared for sweat and for conflict and for tensions and all the rest of it that go to make the things that go to make life troublesome for us at times. But we can't expect to sit back and have all God's blessings handed to us on a silver plate. There is work and there is a battle. And if we're going to get God's blessings, then we've got to do something about it. And that was the lesson that the tribe of Ephraim and also the tribe of Manasseh had to learn. So much then for Joshua, I beg your pardon, so much for the Joseph tribes and for the tribe of Judah. So we have 2.5 east of Jordan. We now have the 2.5 senior tribes west of Jordan. That leaves us with 7 smaller tribes. Now the trouble was, in verse 1 of chapter 18, that the people of Israel had become tired of the battle. We notice in verse 18 that the whole congregation of the people of Israel assembled at Shiloh and set up the tent of meeting there. You notice now that the administrative centre has shifted from Gilgal, where it was for the conquest. It's now set up in Shiloh for the division of the land. Verse 2, "There remained among the people of Israel 7 tribes whose inheritance had not yet been apportioned. So Joshua said to the people of Israel, 'How long will you be slack to go in and take possession of the land, which the Lord, the God of your fathers, has given you?'" Notice the balance there. God has given it to them, but they have to go in and work for it. So there we have it again. You have the two sides of the story. And I think in evangelical circles, we've overemphasized this blessings of God thing too much, as if all God's blessings are open-ended and they're going to be showered down upon us without our having to do anything at all. I simply don't believe these blessings that God promises are as unconditional as that. God has given it to you. Now don't you be slack. You get up and go and possess it. What happens then is that they sent off a delegation of men who surveyed the whole of the remainder of the country and then divided it into 7 portions. And then they drew lots to see which tribe would inherit which portion. So we'll very briefly now touch on these 7 tribes. Verse 11 tells us about the tribe of Benjamin, and if you look at the map, you'll find that Benjamin is a small tribe squeezed in there between Ephraim and Judah. Come to chapter 19, verse 1, and the second lot came out for Simeon. Now Simeon, we are told in verse 9, got no separate tribal area of its own. The inheritance of the tribe of Simeon formed part of the territory of Judah, because the portion of the tribe of Judah was too large for them. And so the tribe of Simeon obtained an inheritance in the midst of Judah's inheritance. There you see Simeon as part of Judah. Come to verse 10, and the third lot came out for the tribe of Zebulun, And if you look at the names that are detailed there, you'll find that Zebulun occupies an area up around that fertile plain of Esdraelon in the Megiddo area up there in the north. You come to verse 17, and the fourth lot came out for Issachar, which is another of those smaller tribes up in the north. In verse 24, the fifth lot came out for the tribe of Asher, which occupied the coastal plain area leading up into Phoenicia. In verse 32, the sixth lot came out for the tribe of Naphtali, up in the hills around the Lake of Galilee, the area that Jesus came from. And then the final lot in verse 40 came out for the tribe of Dan. And you'll notice, if you read those verses through that follow, that Dan received its territory down on the Mediterranean coast. But when you come to the next book, the book of Judges, Dan got squeezed out. You can see why. You have the large tribes of Judah to the south, Ephraim and Manasseh to the north, all expansionist, and Dan wasn't really able to establish itself. In addition, it had trouble with the local Canaanite inhabitants who wanted to push them back from the coastal plain into the hills. And when you come to the book of Judges, then you find that the tribe of Dan migrated, and later on they established themselves up in the very far north of Palestine. So that covers now the division of the land between the 12 tribes. That leaves us now only with chapters 20 and 21 concerning the cities which were allotted to the Levites. And these cities were allotted within each of those tribal areas. We have no time for that now, but that's where we'll pick up the story next Sunday morning.